Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
Welcome to Late Night Live, dear listeners. From the very moment they were born, a little over 50 years ago, Pakistan and India have had incredible troubles. There was the carnage of their birth. There's been, of course, wars in Kashmir, and there's been a very, very dangerous nuclear arms race. This is the context in which last week's terrorist attacks on Mumbai occurred, which have sent the tensions soaring yet again. From the outset, Indian authorities blame militants based in Pakistan as the perpetrators. Pakistan's president says no. The atrocities were committed by stateless individuals who've been operating throughout the region. We're going to look into that tonight with Mustafa Kadri, who's a very, very well-credentialed bloke for the task. But first of all, fracture lines locally. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's historic apology to the stolen generation, well, boy, that began 2008 on the highest of high notes. But, of course, the state of Indigenous affairs in our nation remains troubled. And how exactly Kev will manage to close, quote, the gap that lies between us in life expectancy, in educational achievement and economic opportunity, which he's promised to do so, remains unclear. Now, to discuss the year that was and the year and perhaps years that lie ahead, we welcome back an old friend, Marcia Langton. Marcia is Foundation Professor of Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne and is, of course, one of Australia's leading authorities on contemporary social issues in Aboriginal affairs. Now, Marcia has an essay in the latest Griffith Review and, as might be expected, given its author, it's provocative and compelling, and it's called, somewhat mysteriously, perhaps, The End of Big Men Politics. Marcia joins us from a TARDIS in Melbourne. Marcia, welcome back.
Hello, Philip. How are you?
All the better for hearing your voice. Now, give us an assessment on Rudd's prime ministership so far, pretty much across the board. How many out of 10 do you think?
Well, it's not that easy, is it, Philip? Because we live in a federation. And it's not entirely up to the federal government because there are state governments and territory governments. And because we live in a federation, matters become much more complicated than some of us would like. So, I would give him, you know, 8.5 out of 10 for trying hard, for good intentions, for getting the message right. But then, you know, the hard part starts when he negotiates with COAG, when he sends his ministers to negotiate with state and territory governments. And you've got to ask, you know, how much of it is hitting the ground, the policy, the programs, the, you know, the good intentions, when it has to filter down through considerable bureaucracy.
Well, that's what we're going to do together tonight. We're going to try and nut that out. When you describe the Minister, Jenny Macklin, as hardworking, is that an accolade or are you condemning her with faint praise?
It's an accolade. She has worked very, very hard. And, you know, you can see the kind of shape of the policy being developed. And so, you know, you'd have to give them a tick on quite a number of the issues so far. But, you know, we probably need to add a bit more structure to it. We probably need some timelines, some targets, and I think an approach to the state and territory governments that ties them to an agenda.
You've mentioned, you're talking about the COAG structure. Which of the state and territory governments, dare I ask, are the recalcitrants?
Well, each in their own way have problems. Each state and territory government has, you know, failed on some issue. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give each one of them a scorecard, but, you know, I'd like to see
I get the feeling they'd be pretty low scores.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the issues the Rudd government's been grappling with is what elements of the Howard government's intervention to keep in place following a review of the intervention. They've decided to keep it pretty much as it is for another year. And, of course, that's dividing opinion very, very much within and between the Aboriginal leadership.
Yes, that's right. It is. I think there are some very fundamental misunderstandings about what the point of such an intervention would be. And I think there are some serious problems with the first draft of the intervention. There are some remaining problems. But, to get it right, you just have to move a lot faster than they're moving. You see, in order for it not to be racially discriminatory, and that is, of course, the major objection, it has to be applied to more than the members of one race, i.e. the so-called Aboriginal race. Of course, the federal government is attempting to do that now through a series of trial projects. It started much earlier in the year. And there's, I think, a huge interest in extending conditions to social security payments because of the extraordinary rise in child neglect across the country and even child abuse. But the problem is that people who are human rights advocates and maybe specialists in human rights advocacy aren't across the literature on the welfare state. So, you have to bring a number of different sectors together to find solutions to this problem. And I think it's probably time for the government to bring some of the disparate sectors in this area together to try to find some common understanding.
But what about the disparate Aboriginal leadership? You yourself have been moved to call some of the other Aboriginal leaders naive and ill-informed. It's bewildering and saddening, in fact, for for the well-intended amateur like myself to see old friends really at war.
Philip, you have to have spent a fair bit of time in these areas and you have to have read a fair bit of literature to start engaging in these policy debates. Now, and it's very easy to get so upset about what you see in these communities feel that it's okay to give in to emotion and not take the hard line on some issues. How is it possible? Let me put this to you. How is it possible to stop the alcohol-fueled rage that goes on in so many places when the Aboriginal community is targeted as an easy market for alcohol sales to prevent the abuse of women and children if we don't intervene in that area? Even here in Melbourne, the rise in alcohol-fueled violence in the inner city has become a very serious problem.
I tried to point this out in a column I wrote a year or so ago in The Australian and was castigated by an editorial in the same paper for making exactly that point. I go around to magistrates' courts from time to time and just sit there in astonishment to hear what's going on in nice, white, suburban neighbourhoods.
Yeah, it's not like these problems are confined to Aboriginal people. It's just the extent of the problem.
And the visibility, Marcy, the fact that people take cameras in. It happens behind drawn curtains in white suburbs.
Well, not so much. I mean, here in the inner city of Melbourne, you have, crowds of young people who are, essentially binge drinkers, becoming extremely violent in the middle of the night.
Yes,
an extraordinary increase in ambulance call-outs, hospital admissions, this glassing epidemic, the use of knives, You have increased security in taxi cabs.
Yeah. Okay, you know, point taken. But you certainly don't buy Germaine Greer's theories of Aboriginal violence as an inevitable, indeed, she would argue, almost natural result of historic wrongs.
No, that's nonsense. Her argument's nonsense. She should stick to Shakespeare.
Dear, oh dear. Okay, this is ABC Radio National, Radio Australia via the web and podcast, and I'm talking to the marvellous Marcia Langton, Professor of Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. Let's move on to that fascinating argument in your Griffith Review essay about big bunga politics being at the heart of the problems in Indigenous communities. What are big bunga or bunja politics?
Bunga. Well,
oh,
yeah.
I had two
well,
goes. They're both wrong.
Well, you know, it's a term that, you know, it's basically it's scatological and you can figure out what it means. But it implies, you know, more than just, you know, machoism and more than just patriarchy. It implies sexual predation, the geriatric domination of women. It's one of those, you know, very elastic words that has a lot of meaning. It slides between machoism through to, you know, the use of force by men against women, and in the middle somewhere is, you know, sexuality and, you know. But
that hasn't stopped you. It didn't stop Lowitja O'Donoghue, and it hasn't stopped other Aboriginal women from being absolutely assertive and victoriously so.
It's, you know, it's not, look, we might appear to be fearless, but it's not as if, you know, people haven't tried to bully us, to intimidate us. I've been bullied, intimidated, you know, locked out of buildings, had my tyres slashed, you name it. Foul abuse carved into the Duco on my car, painted on my door.
I remember when the KKK were attacking you in Darwin.
Mm, yes. But I'm not talking about them. But, you know, I mean, this article is about...
I know you were, but you've really copped it, haven't you?
Yeah. And, you know, you can't give in to it, Philip.
No.
You know, what do you have in the end if you give in to bullies, be they, you know, the Ku Klux Klan or, you know, some black man who just can't tolerate women stepping out of line? You know, you have no dignity or self-respect if you cave into that kind of intimidation.
When you chaired the National Indigenous Working Group on Native Title, I understand you'd schedule the difficult agenda items for times in the afternoon when the more troublesome ATSIC commissioners would be at the TAB.
That's correct. That's what I wrote in my article, yes.
You'd start meetings early to avoid the binge drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
You'd fix the air conditioning, too high or too low.
Mm-hmm.
Good God. Okay, let's move on to one of the most compelling statements you make in the essay. You don't believe, and this will shock others, you don't believe that every aspect of Aboriginal tradition needs to be defended. Instead, the push for cultural continuity has to be for healthy cultural continuity. And I remember you talking to me at GAMA some years ago on the issue of grieving, on the sorry, on the treatment of death within a community.
Well, what's happened, you see, is, you know, 30 years ago, you know, the whole of the wet season up north was taken up with ceremonies. And then during the year, there'd be funeral ceremonies and other kinds of ceremonies. And that was okay back then because most Aboriginal people were not in the workforce. And... you know, Aboriginal children who went to school went to mission schools or, you know, the people I worked with very often lived on stock routes and reserves. There were no schools. People had been thrown out of the cattle industry after the equal wages case, and I think we estimated there's something like, well, certainly in excess of 10,000 Aboriginal people were living in fringe camps on stock routes and reserves without any land title.
And but so, as you explained to me at Garma, now, there's a lot of employment in the mining companies for young Indigenous blokes, but they are, in fact, playing hooky very often, using the grieving procedures as an excuse.
Yes, but, you know, there are a lot of people in the mining industry who figured out that, you know, they were actually skiving off, and they just call up the elders and say, where's, you know, Billy? Oh, well, can you tell him to come back to work, please? So I think the mining industry's gotten over that problem now. You know, the nervousness about interfering in what, is said to be a cultural practice. Well, certainly there are people who have to attend ceremonies for long periods of time, but nobody expects young men who've got good jobs to stay at in a sorry camp for a month. That's, not the expectation at all. But I do think two things. One, in some parts of the country, not everywhere, but in a few parts of the country, far too much money is being spent on funerals. And I think that people need to manage funerals so that, it doesn't suck all of the wealth and the time and the energy out of the community.
Yeah.
For some people...
That marvellous O'Regan fellow from New Zealand, the Maori leader,
that
we both met at the last Garma, made the point that the Maori tribes had made quite fundamental adjustments to this quite a while ago.
Yes. But, I'm not saying that, people must do this. I'm just saying let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And I know that more and more people are talking about it. In communities, because, there is far too often children are not in school. Children need to go to school every day. Young people need to go and get jobs and stay in jobs. Quite a few years ago, I came across the problem of house cursing. So in some parts of the country, young people get out of hand and they curse, they use a particular kind of curse on a house or a shop or a truck, and say it's the shop. Well, the shop has to be shut down until the curse is lifted. So nobody can go shopping, and you see women, and their children sitting outside the shop until, the old ceremonial man is brought in. He might be, in another community, and then nobody can go shopping until the store is opened again, until the right ceremony is done.
Well, let's use the problem of shopping in that situation to take us back to income management, which is also leading to some terrible shopping issues, isn't it? In the remote areas. First of all, I was shocked to learn from both you and a background briefing recently that in a lot of those little food stores, the food, the packaging shows that it's out of date. It's beyond the use-by date, the stuff that gets to those communities.
That's sometimes the problem in badly managed stores, yes.
And then there's
sometimes you go in and there's no fruit and vegetables left. Sometimes you go to a store and there's, Coca-Cola and canned meat. It depends. Some stores are very well run, but in some places it's just terrible. Well, and they're all very expensive.
Yes, I've noticed that. Now, one of the things with income control, of course, is that people were forced to take these tokens, these ration cards, effectively, to the major stores as well, which were a long, long way away.
Yeah, that can be the problem. Not all stores are approved under the welfare quarantining system, and I think that's a problem. In most of the major communities, the stores are approved, but you have the problem that people live in outlying communities and they have to go into a larger community, and the cost of travel is enormous, and there's no public transport. There's only taxis, and they're very expensive.
Well, you can look at a $700 bill to go shopping, can't you?
If you live in a remote outstation that's, say more than 200 kilometres from a store, yes.
I briefly mentioned the way you had to manipulate meetings by being clever with the air conditioning or the timing of discussions. So are women, in effect, in remote communities, because I know that Jenny Macklin says that women are coming up to her and say, please don't axe the income management system, while the blokes are demanding that it be axed. So the women are dealing with the same problems in microcosm as you were at the political macro level.
Well, it's actually the reverse. What I was dealing with was the micro problem, and what these women who are lobbying the minister are doing is dealing with the macro problem. You see, first of all, the issue of poverty in Aboriginal communities is a very serious problem. Aboriginal communities are extremely poor. Well below where the communities where welfare quarantining is taking place are extremely poor. So the income average in those communities is far, far below the income average for the poorest postcodes in the big cities. Far, far below it. It's really shocking levels of poverty and deprivation. And then what happens is that, you know, you have a very high proportion of people who are dependent on Social Security income. And that includes a wide variety of people. I know that, you know, there are some people who think that everybody's lazy, but you have the normal range of Social Security recipients. So they're pensioners, single mothers with children, people who are unemployed, disabled people, and very high proportions of Aboriginal people are disabled by kidney disease, diabetes, amputations from diabetes, blindness, and just plain sick anyway. So,
Hence your growing impatience with people who go on about the human rights issues thus tend to eclipse the scale, intensity and urgency of these problems.
That's correct. And you have the problem also of very high levels of alcohol abuse. So the latest figure out of the Northern Territory on the amount of pure alcohol consumed by Northern Territorians in the last year, and remember that the population of the Northern Territory is smaller than, say, two suburbs in a big city, it's quite a small population, 4 million litres of pure alcohol. The highest consumption of alcohol per head of population is in Katherine in the Northern Territory. We're really talking extremes of individual or average, individual intakes of alcohol over a year.
And you, facing the issues, also point out that there's a lot of grog running going on within Indigenous communities by Indigenous entrepreneurs.
That's correct. And it seems, if the figures are right, it's truly shocking, the highest levels of fetal alcohol syndrome in the world.
Oh, dear. Look, I must publicly congratulate you on your contribution to the first Australian series. It's been remarkable. I was particularly moved by your account of Australia's own Barack, William Barack, and I raise that because you realise that what we're talking about have been problems now for a hell of a long time. He was this dignified, aristocratic, highly intelligent bloke trying to do deals, come to reasonable, constructive, creative arrangements with the Victorian authorities and being done over again and again.
And you see this story repeated over and over and over again in Australian history. Did you read Galora Yunupingu's article in The Monthly that's just out?
I read it today,
Does that remind you of Barack?
It does indeed.
Isn't it just the same story all over again?
Yeah. And these stories, as you point out, are not known to the wider white community. That's almost like not even a repressed memory. We've never known the story to begin with. We don't want to know it.
Well, I've tried to explain elsewhere why that might be the case. I find it extraordinary that all of these stories are in the records. And the records are extremely detailed in some cases. And there have been historians like, Richard Broome and, of course, the wonderful the late Diane Barwick, who was the most important ethno-historian of, working in Victoria. Quite a few other historians, of course, and especially here in Victoria. And they have actually published books over the years, but they're not taught. They're not taught in university. They're not taught in school. They're not in the public imagination. But I think
Rachel Perkins have done something about that now, haven't you?
Well, I want to say that Rachel Perkins and Darren Dale, Rachel was the director of First Australians, the series on SBS, and Darren Dale was the producer, have really brought all of these histories into the public imagination. And have done such a wonderful job. It was such a privilege for me to be involved, yeah. Philip.
Well, it's a privilege to actually look at it. I was inspired to write a column on the William Barak story, but I wonder if you'd be good enough just to tell the listener its essence, because it's such a powerful yarn.
Well, you know, dispossessed and pushed further and further into smaller areas of land, the William Barak's people actually became farmers. They were very successful, but the Aboriginal Protection Board was constantly lobbied by farmers for more, to take more and more of their land. And that even when very decent settlers came to defend Aboriginal people like Anne Bonn and Mr Green and so on, the Protection Board maintained a policy of splitting up the Aboriginal population and taking away all the part Aboriginal people and leaving only, you know, a few old elders. William Barak led delegations. He walked, even with a broken leg, he walked to Victoria, down to Melbourne. He carried his son. His son ended up in hospital. His son died in hospital alone.
And he wasn't allowed to go into the hospital.
The whole story is heartbreaking. So basically they were systematically dispossessed. Their families were broken up. They were humiliated. It is the most tragic story. It is awful.
Yeah. And it could be, without too much trouble, it could be reset in the 21st century. And that's the really horrifying aspect of it. And yet, you come again and again to positive examples of communities finding new solutions to these problems in constructive ways. You talk at length, for example, from an apology made by hundreds of blokes in July this year at the first National Aboriginal Men's Health Conference.
Yes. The Endurica statement is really a marvellous statement. It's quite long, and I've only cited part of it in my essay. But, you know, their analysis I agree with completely. It's a terrific piece of work. And, you know, the point is that men are just as vulnerable as women to the larger politic of the separate treatment of Aboriginal people by the system. You see, If men are violent towards women, it's because they are victims of, you know, the alcohol trade.
And there's also a high degree of self-hatred in this sort of violence in any case.
Well, let's put it in the positive in the way that they do. How do men, Aboriginal men, find self-esteem in, you know, these appalling parts of the country where nobody has a good thing to say?
Yeah,
and the way that all Indigenous policy and affairs are framed, it's all in the negative, you see. And I think a pretty fundamental rethink has to take place. But at the same time, Philip, you see, people seem to think that Social Security is a human right. It's not that Social Security is a human right. What is a human right is equal treatment under the law. That's what a human right law becomes relevant.
Yeah.
Social Security is a government policy, and Social Security policies treat people differently. Pensioners are treated differently from unemployment benefit recipients,
yeah,
for obvious reasons, you know. Single parents are treated differently from the previous two groups for obvious reasons. And so treating people equally is not the point. The point is that the, you know, the laws and the policies are designed for different groups according to their needs. So human rights insist that people are treated equally under the law. So that means that all single parents be treated equally according to the policies. Yeah? So you can't discriminate against a particular person. When a policy changes for some reason, that's not a human rights abuse. If a policy changes so that one section of the population is treated differently from another section of the population, it's true that it's a human rights abuse if it's done on the grounds of race. And of course, that is the problem with the welfare quarantining as it stands, as it stood up until earlier this year when trialling of welfare quarantining across all sections of the population began.
Yeah.
But it's not true that cutting somebody's social security and ensuring that, you know, one segment of it is used only on food, it's not true that that is a human rights abuse. In fact, you know, you have had this in America with food stamps, you know. And so why do you have such policies? So that the vulnerable are fed, have enough nutrition, you see?
Well, you're now emphasising the harsh realities that have to be dealt with. Let's end our discussion where we began it. Let's go back to your earlier point about the federal government, and we're talking about the hard-working Jenny Macklin and her clearly well-intentioned boss, the Prime Minister, having to get the state and the territory governments to agree to this agenda. How do you get the state government and the Northern Territory in particular to line up and do what they're told?
Well, obviously, I think that more work has to be put into the Council of Australian Governments. They've recently met. They're handing out bonuses to carers and, you know, a variety of, you know, vulnerable sections of the population. On Monday, $1,000 checks go into people's accounts. I hate to think what's going to happen with that money. You know, it should be staggered. It's, you know, you can't just inject that much money into poor communities and expect that, you know, everything's going to be all right. I know in Western Australia there's concern about the money being spent on alcohol, and right across Western Australia there's there are measures being taken to ensure that, you know, there are restrictions on the sales of alcohol. I just don't think that the federal government is being consistent at the COAG level in responding to the financial crisis, balancing that against the, you know, the need to have a, you know, highly structured, serious policy that brings Aboriginal people into the economy as genuine participants.
I'd like to remind the listener that they have an urgent need to get the DVDs for the First Australians, the television series, and also to get the book, First Australians, an Illustrated History, in which I have to say your chapter, Marcia, is particularly powerful. As Nicholas Rothwell said, its great strength is its restrained tone shot through with a horrified awareness of the imperial negotiations and transactions underway. And as well as that, of course, there's your End of Big Men Politics, published in Griffiths Review 22, Money, Sex, Power. And, Marcia, you've got to put a bit of effort in. You've been slacking lately. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too.
That's Marcia. Marcia Langton, Foundation Professor of Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. And, boy, she's been keeping it up for decades. I don't know how she does it. This is LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. And now, as promised, Pakistan and India.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.